This is Adrian from GearyaGirl.com on the official GearyaGirl.com podcast. I'm checking in from our third ever Twin Cities PCC workshop. This time we're in Minneapolis at the Convention Center, which has been a really cool facility. I like the fact that there's a Dun Brothers right there on site. That suits me very well, but it's been great to hang out again with Al and Danny Cavadlo, and the group of people who've showed up for this workshop have just been amazing in terms of their own athleticism and their thirst for knowledge and learning. On the first day, we've already covered tons of progressions that they can use, you know, again, for themselves, but also for their clients. We've gone through everything from, you know, the very most basic wall push-ups all the way down to the one-arm push-up, which we had a couple of people get that for the first time today. People that were, you know, already strong enough but were missing kind of those cues, those crucial little details and awarenesses that really make some of these super high-level calisthenic moves possible. So I'm looking forward to seeing what all they do tomorrow. But today we covered push-ups, we covered pull-ups, we covered the human flag and the clutch flag, as not in that order. Obviously, we do clutch flag, which is closer to the pole than the human flag first, to give people the idea of being, you know, out and horizontal in the middle of the air. After lunch, we did our muscle-up progressions, as well as, you know, got into a really nice discussion of, you know, really the philosophies behind a lot of the work that we do with calisthenics. So a ton of knowledge was dropped here on the first day, the Friday PCC workshop. Amusingly, there's a volleyball, I don't know if it's a tournament or what. It looks pretty serious. I'm terrible at volleyball, but fortunately there's other people that are very good at it. But there's a lot of volleyball girls running around, and then there's us, and then there's some kind of dance competition. So the Minneapolis Convention Center is full of a bunch of very energetic, very athletic people of all ages. That's another really cool thing about the PCC curriculum. You really can use this with clients or yourself, you know, at many levels and at many ages. I'm really super proud to report that we have some incredible women athletes and trainers and instructors here this time. And just the women who have showed up have, you know, they've shown an amazing amount of athleticism, of strength, and they've been really picking stuff up quickly. I'm personally very proud of a couple of people got the kind of a, it's a precursor to the full muscle up, but it's kind of, there's a little bit of a jump there. And I taught them some of my own very secret, not so secret, progressions of how to get toward that first full hang, non-kip muscle up. And, you know, these women just really took to it. And everybody's been really respecting, you know, their own level, where they're at in terms of their own abilities, but also balancing that out with a willingness to give things a try. It's tired. It's 11:37 Central. I'm a late night person, but when you're helping out a whole bunch of people learn, and it's so very exciting and engaging, and you know, there's been a visit to Fogo de Chao, a very non-vegetarian visit to Fogo de Chao. I'm ready to get some sleep and really, you know, get into it again tomorrow. We've got a big day planned, a lot more progressions, a lot more fun, and I'm sure there's going to be many more instances of people really getting a concept, really owning a concept, again, for themselves, but also in such a way that they can go back and use this with their students and their clients to really help them get to that next level with calisthenics. I guess really one of the things that I like about the PCC and Convict Conditioning is that it, you know, even if you're working by yourself, we've got a couple of guys that are attending just as enthusiasts, and I think that's fantastic. You know, this is basically their sport. So, you know, if you're somebody who is a real extrovert, you can go out there into places like Tompkins Square Park, and it's almost like you have instant friends who are all into the same stuff. You can join any number of these calisthenics groups. They get together, and there's a lot of energy, and they really inspire each other. But on the flip side, if you tend to be a little bit more introverted, or if you just don't have a lot of time, or maybe you're a little bit shy, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. We don't all have to be, you know, big extrovert people, hey, look at me, or, you know, people that enjoy being around large crowds. You can do this stuff at home. And, you know, convict conditioning, when I first got that book, I practiced a lot of it by myself in my room with the door shut. You know, it can happen anywhere. And there's something very empowering about that kind of information being available. It's like, okay, well, maybe the problem started with me. Well, the problem can end with me too. I can take these progressions and I can work through them. And over time, you know, gosh, what they lead to can be just an incredible mastery of yourself in space, of your poise, of your posture, and all of these kind of goals being accomplished on a regular basis are super empowering for other areas of your life. I was talking the other day with somebody about the slacklining experience. And, you know, here's something that was very difficult for me at the beginning. And I failed 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 at it. And then one day I was able to stand on one foot on there. And then I was able to put another foot on there. And here was something that had seemed like, oh my gosh, this is impossible. I've wasted everyone's time. I've wasted my own money getting this stupid thing. And I stuck with it and stuck with it. And, you know, now I can walk down and back on this. I'm looking at doing, you know, various, not really fancy tricks, but, you know, being able to turn around, being able to just, you know, even just hang out up there and will, you know, get your will going to a point where, yeah, I'm going to make it to the end of there. And sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. I think there's a lot of power in that type of learning. And Al was saying pretty much the exact same thing today. You know, here's something that you've had to struggle with and learn with over time. And just being able to kind of experience that in a small way with a calisthenics move or an exercise can be so empowering for other areas of your life and other things that you're trying to work on. So, you know, that's a huge kind of general message. And the other great thing, again, is I've started people of the grandmother age on convict conditioning in the past, and they don't really know it's from a book called Convict Conditioning. They don't necessarily need to know. You know, it can be progressive calisthenics, whatever it needs to be, but those first steps, really almost anyone can at least get moving with them, and I think that's what's so powerful, especially, you know, with the state of people's health in the U.S. and also around the world. Now, I have received a few messages that you guys think I'm not talking about kettlebells enough. and I promise you I will be getting back to more kettlebells. I'm working on a number of different very interesting programs. But I wanted to mention to you really quick something, again, speaking of the basics. And no one's beyond the basics. We can all get better at the basics. I forget who said it, but about 20 of my friends quote this. It's like, what's an expert? It's someone who's really, really good at the basics. And in martial arts, you know, there's always talk of being in that beginner's mind and of really just drilling down on those basics. And in a recent interview that I did with Dr. Thomas Roth of The End of Back Pain, his recent book just came out April 8th, and there's an incredibly powerful article that's on dragondoor.com. I'm going to put all these links at the bottom about, you know, kettlebells and the lower back pain and really kind of dispelling the idea of if someone is in pain that they shouldn't exercise. And he's a neurosurgeon. He has a lot of very good information on there that you can use to, you know, start a dialogue with your physical therapist, physician, etc. If back pain is something affecting you, to see if maybe this might be a new strategy. But anyway, Dr. Roth is a very incredible guy. He really just sets out some great great information. But one of the things that he said that really, really stuck with me in the interview, because I asked him, I'm like, hey, you know, let's say as an instructor, you have somebody come in, they've been cleared by their doctor to work on this type of thing. What is really the kicker for someone with back pain? And he said something that I kind of theorized might be the case, but he really nailed it. The difference between back bending and hip hinging. And anyone that's learned a kettlebell swing properly or who has been teaching others the very basic kettlebell swing knows that difference. And all this power comes from the hips. We're not putting it into our back. And when we get into that hip hinge, we're pushing our hips way back. I have one client that that doesn't mean anything to. If you say stick your butt out, she does the perfect hip hinge. But basically, you're keeping the abs engaged, keeping that back straight and flat while getting all the power from the hips. He mentioned that that really is, you know, the big takeaway. And just getting people moving in a more healthy way. Like if someone drops something on the ground in public, generally speaking, you're going to see this. It's painful for me to watch a lot of times, this serious, serious back bend. And as a society, we're in that position a lot, of that hunching forward, you know, staring at our computer screens or our phones, or, you know, even in driving, you'll see a lot of people with that head forward type of movement, zero abdominal things going on. And so then they adopt that kind of position within the rest of their life. They come to you to learn a kettlebell swing, and you're like, okay, well, we're going to learn the hip hinge. If you come to me, you're definitely going to, I'm going to hand you a dowel, and you're going to have those three points of contact. You're going to have the upper back, the sacrum, and then, of course, the back of your head. And, you know, you tell people to do the hip hinge with that, and the first few times, so that dowel is just popping up all over the place, and they, people realize, hey, I didn't realize I was bending in the middle of my back so much. And slowly, an amazing thing happens as these habits change. Not only do they start hip hinging in kettlebell class or with some of their other calisthenics, this movement makes its way into their life. And a lot of times they'll find that, hey, you know, I'm not getting a stiff lower back so much. And so what Dr. Roth had to say really kind of met up with that observation. So again, you know, if you currently are trying to do kettlebell swings by kind of learning them on your own on videos online, there's a lot of bad information out there, but also it's hard to really know where you are in space, because this movement is very different than what most people have learned anywhere. So I would really encourage you to find an RKC or an HKC, I told you it was late, RKC or HKC instructor, and learn that crucial hip hinge, that abdominal engagement, and these, you know, very healthy movement patterns. And also, if you are an instructor, I'd encourage you to go ahead and, we have a little pop quizzes in my classes sometimes, and even with my one-on-one clients, where it's like, okay, well, you know what? I brought the dowels out. Let's see where your hip hinge is at. And 9 times out of 10, we'll do that before moving up to a heavier kettlebell, because I want to see where they're at. I want to make sure they're not going to try to cheat this thing and hurt themselves. And that's pretty much the way that we've been able to really start swinging very heavy. The small group people that are training with me right now are all swinging, men and women, are all swinging the 40 kilo. It might be for low reps. It might not be quite chest height, but they are getting that power transfer. They're getting that serious hip snap and hip hinge. And it's an amazing thing to watch. And of course, it's a whole lot of fun too for everybody involved. So again, I would encourage you, revisit the hip hinge, either with yourself, with your clients, preferably both. And, you know, in the comments section of the website, let me know what happens. And I wish you all the best with your training. Next up is a little kind of an interview slash conversation with another Adrienne. She is actually not a fitness instructor at all, but she's a serious, serious health food enthusiast. And she has some of the most innovative recipes that I've seen for a while. Anyway, this was originally going to be its own podcast, but I wanted to kind of just check in with you a little bit with, you know, the PCC, and also, you know, reinstating how important that hip hinge is with your kettlebell movements and also in your life. But anyway, right next 5 seconds from now, you're going to hear from Adrienne Frankenfield. She has an amazing blog that she's going to tell you all about. We're going to talk about fermented foods, raw foods, and while she primarily eats a plant-based diet, the way that she eats and the way that I eat are remarkably similar, and they're probably similar to how you're eating as well. And besides, we can all stand to eat more vegetables. Hi, this is Adrienne Harvey from GearYourGirl.com, and I've got a special treat for you today. We're deviating a little bit from our usual plan. I'm not talking to someone who's a kettlebell or bodyweight exercise instructor. Her name is also Adrienne, so you're listening to two Adriennes today, which might get a little bit confusing. I haven't told her this, but I think of us as she's the light twin and I'm the dark twin. You'll see why. But anyway, she is super enthusiastic about health and foods. And while she actually eats closer to a raw vegan diet, which is obviously those of you who follow my blog know that's not what I do, she and I've actually discovered that we have more in common than not. She's a health-minded food blogger, and I'll be getting her to talk a little bit more about her new blog with a lot of recipes that you'll probably enjoy as well. But she's been able to fix her own health to a very high degree by eating a lot of these super high-quality foods, fermented foods, probiotics, and I love going over to her house because she likes to share a lot of these delicious foods, and as you all know, I like to eat. So anyway, this is Adrienne Frankenfield, and please tell them what I missed.
That was a pretty good introduction.
Thank you.
As you mentioned, I had a whole food diet, mostly vegan, mostly raw. I don't like to be too legalistic about it, but I'm very passionate about fermented foods. Some of the health problems that I've been able to reverse by eating this way are Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is an autoimmune thyroid disease, asthma, seasonal allergies, some food allergies, have a lot more energy, and you even got me swinging kettlebells occasionally, so it's all good.
Yes, that's right. You did really well with that, so I was happy to see that. Yeah, Adrienne is also a very gifted photographer, and I had ulterior motives in teaching her the kettlebell swing, so it actually works out that it helps the photography too. Anyway, multi-talented. Yeah.
You convinced me that it's a far more efficient way to exercise than running.
Well, it is. It is. It is. So what's the name of your blog now, and when did you start it?
It is called tasteoftwoplates.com. Mm-hmm. I've actually only had it up for probably about 3 weeks now. I was motivated to do it because I would share some of my recipes on social media, and as you said, I like to feed people, and so I will bring food to events, and people kept asking, when are you going to get a food blog up? When are you going to get a food blog up? And I figured that was kind of the universe's way of telling me I should just do it. So so that's what I'm doing. I call it Taste of Two Plates because I attempt to feed my husband some of this stuff too. So everything that I make is usually a portion to feed two people, maybe just one of you, but two of me. He does not eat the way that I do, but it's usually good to get feedback from, you know, other people who don't maybe have the same taste in food.
Yeah, I don't want to call him out, but I was pretty amused that while you and I, last time I visited, were drinking this amazing kombucha, eating this raw cheesecake that you'd made from cashews and strawberries, the doorbell rings, and it's the pizza guy. I was just like, all right, I'm not going to say anything, but that is just hilarious. And
that's about how it works. You know, about once a week, the doorbell will ring, and it's the pizza guy. And I'm like, you sure you don't want some vegetables? I have vegetables on the pizza. Okay, I love you.
That's so funny. But you know what? That's important. And, you know, that type of acceptance. And then also, you know, it's a good reality check, because sometimes I know I can get so far off into la-la land with, like, you know, extremes of flavors and palates that it's great to have somebody that's a little bit closer to a mainstream palate to try some of this stuff.
That's exactly why I have him tested, because sometimes I'll bring it to like potlucks when I hang out with my friends, and they're all like, "This is great," because a lot of them will eat, eat the way that I do. I go to vegan potlucks with some of my friends, and I have him sample stuff as a reality check, because I want to make sure that if I'm feeding other people who haven't been eating the way that I have, that they'll find it enjoyable too. So it's, for the most part, he is pretty healthy. The pizza is not like an everyday thing. He makes his green smoothies in the morning, and, he'll get salads for lunch sometimes. So.
Right on. So what is your favorite recipe right now?
That's up on the blog. You know what? I have to say it's the collard rolls. I took collards and I used them as a wrap, and I made kind of like a sushi alternative to stuff with vegetables. And I did, the lemon dill avocado sauce inside. It kind of gives it a little bit more punch, adds a little good fat to the recipe, keeps it from being too green and crunchy. Mm-hmm. But that's my favorite so far. It might just be because I really like finger foods, but I thought it was good. I like wraps and rolls and things that kind of work out well just to snack on. I like to graze.
Right.
The flavors were good, which is important to me.
Now, when I think of collards, I a lot of times think of the leaves being very tough. How do you get around that?
Around them being very tough?
Yeah.
So collards actually make really good wraps and rolls. And what I found in working with them is that they'll hold together well, and you can still chew them, but the parts that make them difficult to roll is that really thick stem. And so what I do is I just take a knife and kind of fillet the fat part of the stem off from the underside of the leaf, and then it rolls up, a lot easier. It's a lot more flexible that way.
That's really cool. Because, from my side of things, kind of on the more primal and to a lesser degree paleo, I jokingly tell people I eat yuppie Atkins. Because I eat predominantly lower carb, but very high quality foods. Like if I eat cheese, it's not, American cheese slices. It's, usually some kind of delicious grass-fed cheese or goat cheese, sheep's cheese, things like that. We're always looking for, ways to make wraps and, alternatives to things like tortillas or bread, and finger foods are, they're fun to eat and they're very accessible. For people that are starting out, I think.
Yeah, so. I have a lot of those kinds of recipes on the blog, too, so far. I mean, it's only been up for 3 weeks, but it seems to be a trend. And I do have some that are low-carb, too. I believe in balancing everything out. I like to practice food combining most of the time, so, try to keep my carbs and my fats in separate meals because they digest better that way.
Right.
But I do have some low-carb meals on there. I actually just posted a coleslaw recipe with an avocado sauce instead of mayonnaise. I think mayonnaise is kind of gross, but at least the store-bought stuff is. I'm sure that you can probably make your own with some really good, like, free-range grass-fed. Chickens don't eat grass, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, I love free-range chicken eggs because, this is really gross, but they'll eat bugs. And yeah. I find that, the chickens that eat bugs, the eggs from those, man, my nails will just grow like crazy. Like I have to keep nail clippers out on my desk or my typing speed takes a hit. okay. So you're saying, here's the thing. We have some great recipes out there for healthy fats and mayonnaise and stuff. But I mean, in the real world, it's just so much easier to mash up an avocado and just go.
I completely agree. And a lot of times I'll put them in the blender because it makes them really, silky and creamy. But if you have a good ripe avocado, you can just beat it with a potato masher. In fact, that's actually why I bought my potato masher. I've never used it on potatoes. I've only used it to mash avocados.
That's hysterical. Well, I'm really lazy, so I just take the back of a fork and go to town. Yeah, that's something people don't know about me. I will do... I will go to strange lengths to wash one or two less utensils. So there's a protocol that has been established with a lot of my recipes that will, have the order of the construction of things a particular way so that there are the fewest amount of dishes or items to be washed. So it's very popular with the bachelor set as well.
I can imagine. My husband was like that when I found him. He didn't really own any kitchen appliances. He had maybe a toaster and a fork and like two plates.
My, how his life has changed. Now, you know, for your food strategies and for the way that you cook, I love coming over and seeing what you have, but you've got some specialized equipment that, you know, I don't necessarily have. But I guess could you list off, you know, what are like the top three things that you feel like you need to have in order to eat the way that you do?
Sure. I would say a high-powered blender. I personally prefer Vitamix. I use mine almost every day between all the smoothies and sauces and things that I make, but it spins so fast that it can break open the cell wall. So, you know, it really blends in the leafy greens and maximizes the nutrition that you can get out of them. And I believe that leafy greens are a major part of a healthy diet. So I would say that my Vitamix is probably my number one tool. I would say second would be my dehydrator, because of a lot of the food allergies and things that I can't have, I gave up on baking and I really miss bread. So the dehydrator actually allows me to make some really good nutritious sprouted bread that have. I can even reuse some of my juice pulp in the breads too for a little extra boost of fiber. I have a recipe on the blog for a juice pulp bread too that I've been eating for breakfast with a little bit of like a natural fruit spread on it. It's really good.
Oh, that's cool. Waste not, want not.
Yeah. I don't have a yard to compost that stuff anymore. So now I try to reincorporate it into other recipes. Mm-hmm. And number three, well, I would have said food processor a while ago, but now I have the variable speed Vitamix. Mm-hmm. You know, I would probably still go with food processor because there are just some things that a food processor can do that that a blender can't. Like I can slice and great stuff with it. So right. I have a recipe with a lot of shredded carrots, so I'm not having to buy the bags of pre-shredded carrots that have, you know, who knows what kind of preservative is great on them. I just run all my organic carrots through there, and they're chopped in about 2 minutes.
That's
so
awesome.
I think my food processor is number three on my list.
Cool. And, you know, a lot of people already have, you know, either the Vitamix or the BlendTec, you know, those kind of, you know, high-end blenders. So, I mean, it makes things a lot more accessible. That's really cool. I kind of miss my dehydrator sometime when you mentioned the breads. Do you ever make those? It's really simple, but it's like flax seeds. You grind them up and you mix in like a little bit of sea salt, a little bit of water, and make like a cracker out of it.
Yeah. I've made flax crackers. I haven't put any recipes on the blog for that yet, but I do like flax. It's a good source of omega fatty acids. And mm-hmm. it's good source of fiber too if you use the ground flax meal instead of the whole flax seeds. It helps to kind of keep out your intestines. But anyway,
it's always
we
a good
talk
thing
about that.
I just liked it because they were kind of crunchy and salty, and they were, you know, still very good to eat. They weren't like you know, busting open a bag of corn chips. When I had a friend recently who I didn't expect this from told me that they ate like a half a bag of organic corn chips, and I was like,
wow,
really? I'm like, okay, have fun with that.
Well, I make my own sometimes. I get the organic frozen corn, so that, you know, there's no GMOs in it,
right?
And then you can blend in some other vegetables like red bell peppers, one that I like to put in, and then you add some flax to that and a little sea salt and some seasonings, and you dehydrate it, and then you got basically, you know, a healthy vegetable chip. So you can do that too. And you don't have to worry about, you know, any of the oils that they've been fried in, because a lot of that stuff breaks down under high heat.
Oh yeah. And it sounds like that actually sounds pretty good. I'm not a massive fan of corn, but I'd probably definitely give that a try.
Now, it's pretty good. You can make chips out of pretty much anything in a dehydrator. It's really fun to play with.
That's cool. It's neat because a lot of people, you know, even again, if they're eating more like you or if they're eating more like me, the focus is really on overall food quality in both cases. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about on here more was, you know, there's so much, you know, division, especially online, so much us and them. And what strikes me more are the similarities and the similar priorities that both you and I have. With our food choices, we care about where the food comes from. You know, just by what you've been saying, in terms of, you know, how the food has been processed or not processed before it reaches you. And, you know, these are really important concepts regardless of how someone chooses to eat, be they vegan, be they raw, primal, or yuppie Atkins, or, you know, ovo-lacto vegetarian. It's always tough to see, like, a young person who, you know, says, oh, I'm vegetarian, and you see they're eating basically vegetarian junk food, and it's like, oh, come on, you know.
It just kills me. I know some of those people, too.
Yeah. It's like, great idea, but let's work on the details.
and I think that's why sometimes vegetarianism gets a bad rap, and sometimes people think that a lot of vegetarians aren't healthy. It's because it's true. A lot of them, they start off doing it with their heart in the right place because they want to be kinder to the planet, but they haven't really done the research about how to do it in a way that's beneficial for their health, you know, how to pick out the whole unprocessed ingredients, you know, understanding the fact that if they are not eating animal proteins, that they need more leafy greens in their diet so they can get good quality plant protein in there too. So I think that's where a lot of the stigma around vegetarianism comes from, is these junk food vegetarians who haven't really learned how to eat quality food yet.
Yeah, it's like many years ago, I was overseas and our vegetarian friends had, we went to fish and chips. I had fish and chips. They had chips. I'm like, that's not dinner. Come on.
No, I totally agree. I'm not really on board with the whole potato thing, too. it's way too much starch for me.
Yeah, I'm obviously not a huge starch person over here. But you know what? Recently, this came up on Mark's Daily Apple the other day, and I was super intrigued. Do you know anything about resistant starches, like in cooked then cooled legumes?
Not really, because since I do a lot of raw food, there are certain starches that you just can't eat, like potato. You have to cook it in order for it to be digestible. Although you can juice it, and the juice is supposed to be okay, but I'm really been interested in trying that. You can eat sweet potatoes raw. Sometimes I'll spiralize them and then make like a sweet potato salad. Sweet potato juice is surprisingly good mixed with cabbage as well. I know it sounds a little weird, but it totally takes the bite out of the cabbage juice.
Wow, that would never have occurred to me. That's really interesting. Because I know a lot of people that, you know, are interested in health food topics are super into juicing. And that's, you know, that's something that I don't do at all. But I know that a lot of people have that interest. So sweet potato and cabbage.
Wow. Yeah, it really started because I used to have a lot of digestive problems, and cabbage has a lot of nutrients in it that are good for digestion, but I could not get it down. And one day somebody on one of the vegetarian forums that I was hanging out on at the time suggested that I mix it with sweet potato, and I thought it was really weird, but I tried it. It was the only thing I found that would blend well with the cabbage.
That is so interesting. Well, you know, the only sweet potatoes I've eaten raw have been, I'm cutting them up on the cutting board and I'm probably a little hungry. So I'll eat, you know, little pieces here and there. And I'm like, you know, it's not so bad. What's that?
Oh, I was going to say, I've made some pretty good sweet potato chips in the dehydrator too. And you just toss them with a little bit of olive oil and sea salt and, you know, stick them in overnight and they're come out nice and crunchy.
That sounds great. Now, something I just thought of, recently I shared a recipe that I feel kind of bad talking about it right here, but it's coming out in a newsletter that's only for Dragon Door certified instructors. Down probably a few months after it's been out there, I'll share it publicly. But it's a special recipe for lentil-based tabbouleh salad. You know, I love tabbouleh salad. I love the flavors of it. But the idea of eating bulgur wheat, I just can't bother anymore. And part of me started thinking, you know, I don't necessarily have to do this with cooked lentils. I could sprout the lentils. And
actually, that is the way that I make my tabbouleh. I use sprouted lentils.
Oh, well, I'm sure yours is delicious.
It's basically, you can take any classic tabbouleh recipe that you see online and you can use sprouted lentils. Another substitution that works really well is like grated cauliflower. In place of the bulgur wheat. It gives it a nice a nice texture and you don't have to wait for the lentils to sprout if you're in a hurry.
Oh, that's great. Well, because, you know, a lot of us who eat lower carb or who are, you know, avoiding certain types of starches already, you know, have cauliflower around, using it for like cauliflower rice, cauliflower mash, and things like that. I didn't think of using it in tabbouleh. That is really cool. See, this is why I wanted you on this call, because these little gems.
I got that one to my last vegan potluck, actually. It went over really well.
I'm sure. Well, there's just so much extra nutrition in there, too, with the different vegetables. So one of the other things, one of the other many things that you and I have in common are a love of fermented foods.
Yes.
And you said you've got some batches of sauerkraut going on right now. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, sauerkraut is super easy to make. And contrary to popular belief, it is not smelly unless you cook it and you start releasing the sulfuric compounds. And, but if you make it, you know, just to have it ferment and eat it raw, it doesn't smell at all. But it's really simple. So you take, the way that I do it is I take for each small head of organic cabbage, I add about 2 tablespoons of kosher salt and then kind of massage it in until the cabbage starts to release its juices. So what you're doing, it's like a traditional brine, except you're using the juice from the cabbage to create the brine with the salt instead of water. So you're brining the cabbage in its own juices.
Okay, so have you shredded the cabbage first? Or?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Okay. Yeah, I shred it. You just chop it into really thin slices. You can use green or purple cabbage. If you mix them together, it turns pink. It's really pretty. Ooh. Actually, I got a batch of pink sauerkraut that I just pulled out of my jars before we got on the call. I tasted it. It's all good. so after it starts to release the juices, you can add other seasonings like caraway seed. I like to put some shredded carrots in mine too, just because it tastes good.
Yeah.
And then you pack it in a jar. You weigh it down so that the cabbage stays under the brine, and you let it sit for a couple weeks. And, you know, check it every couple of days to make sure that it's still below the water level. Taste it, and when it tastes like sauerkraut, you can eat it.
Wow. So, all right, I'm going to ask some really kind of simple questions, just because I'm not always sure. So are you leaving this out on the countertop? Is this in the fridge?
Oh, it's at room temperature. Okay. There are some people that have done a lot more research on sauerkraut than I have, and some of them say that you can actually do a really long ferment on it. So ideally you would, because back in the old days they would make it and then store it in like their root cellars, which is like 55, 60 degrees. So there are some people that say, you know, you can ferment it on the counter for, you know, 1 to 2 weeks, and then you should ferment it in your refrigerator, you know, at this 55 to 60 degree temperature range for, you know, another 8 to 12 weeks if you want. And I read an interesting article about this recently where it was talking about the different histamine levels and how it, as the lactobacillus, you know, start to multiply at the beginning of the fermentation process, the histamine levels are a little bit higher. But as it goes on over time, the histamine levels will drop. So if you're somebody that has a lot of allergy problems, a really long fermented sauerkraut might actually work better for you.
Well, that's interesting. Hopefully people will be able to wait that long. I'm pretty sure I won't. But
No, I can't. I got to tell you, as soon as it's ready, I start eating it.
Yeah, sounds about right. Yeah, I've got to come down there and try some of that, because, you know, everything that you've made has just been really cool. Now, you have some kombucha going right now, or what's going on with
that? Yes, I've actually got a glass on the table here right next to me. This particular batch is peach, cinnamon, and ginger.
Wow.
And I've got a batch of kombucha beer going right now.
What is that?
So I bought this bottle of kombucha beer that I found at Whole Foods, and I went to their website to try to get an idea of how they were fermenting it to make it alcoholic, because I don't drink a lot, you know, because there's a lot of additives and stuff that's in there, plus, you know, it's just not good for your liver.
Right.
But I was really curious about their process, and it seemed to indicate that they were doing some kind of like 30-day open ferment on it.
Wow.
So I made a regular batch of kombucha, and then I put it into a, you know, into a glass container, and I left a piece of SCOBY in there, and then every week or whatever, I would just feed it more sugar so that the probiotic and the yeast content would go up, and it would incrementally make a little bit more alcohol in it. So I just pulled the SCOBY out a couple of days ago, and I dehydrated it and made a delicious ginger gummy SCOBY candy thing.
Wow. Yeah, I remember when you were first talking about trying to figure out ways to, you know, use and recycle SCOBY, and it's pretty fascinating that you've been able to do that.
I've done a few experiments with them. Some of the thinner ones, I'll dehydrate it, and they get crunchy almost, but still kind of chewy, so I'll marinate them and make a SCOBY jerky out of them. Some of the thicker ones, they don't really dehydrate the same way, but they'll get gummy. But if you marinated them in some kind of flavoring, in this case, it was soaking in a ginger mixture, so it's like a gummy, ginger candy if you chop it up into little pieces. And then sometimes I just take the chunks and drop them in my smoothies. You can blend them up if you have a good blender, and you get an extra dose of probiotic. You don't even know what's in there.
Wow. So kind of just to sum up for, you know, those of us who are not quite as, you know, involved on the same level that you are, but want to kind of get our feet wet, or to just, you know, get more vegetables in our diet, it sounds like a high-powered blender really is probably the first thing that we should go for.
I would say so. It's actually one of how I healed my thyroid condition.
Wow.
I had made some dietary modifications, and I was able to get my antibody count down. But, you know, my endocrinologist had told me even if I got my antibody count, my thyroid would never heal itself, because once the damage is done, it's permanent, and then I'd be on medication for the rest of my life. Well, I got my antibody count down, and I had just learned about green smoothies, and I started making them, and probably a couple months into it, my thyroid hormone levels started to stabilize, because my thyroid was healing itself, and 6 months later, I was completely off my medication.
Wow.
So, and for the first time in my life, I actually had really thick white fingernails. My hair color became more vibrant. My vision actually improved. That's one of the things that I learned, too, that if you have a thyroid condition, it can make you slightly nearsighted, and my eye doctor didn't believe me. He said that I just had to, my glasses were too strong from the first time, and then my previous eye doctor must have messed up. But my vision actually improved as my thyroid healed.
That makes sense. That's really fascinating. Okay, so what, can you give us your favorite green smoothie recipe? Because I don't have any issues, but hey, we can always do better. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I would say that for somebody who's never tried green smoothies before, spinach is usually a nice mild one to start with. An easy one that my husband really likes, and you know, he doesn't eat the way I do, but when he makes his green smoothies, he likes to do usually like 1 cup of water to 1 cup of chopped greens. He'll throw 1 or 2 bananas in there and a scoop of peanut butter.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he still gets his greens in there, but it tastes like bananas and peanut butter.
Smart. What kind of greens does he use?
You know what? He's surprisingly not picky about his greens. I told him that he needs to rotate his greens. So we'll use spinach, we'll use green leaf lettuce, we'll use romaine. He puts collards in his smoothies sometimes.
Wow.
I like to use like cilantro and dill and some of the aromatics sometimes. Basil and mango is actually one of my favorite combinations. I really love it when mangoes are in season. I'll do green leaf lettuce and a big handful of basil and a mango and maybe a banana, and then just blend it up with enough water to get the consistency that I want.
I wasn't even hungry, but now I am.
Sorry.
Super cool. No, it's okay. I expected that. I had a snack before the call, and I was like, okay, you don't know what's going to happen here. So, now, what's next with you? You're, you know, going to continue to grow the blog. You're going to, keep sharing wonderful recipes.
I am going to continue to grow the blog. I'm actually taking some additional nutrition classes right now.
Cool.
So that I can start to put a better nutritional breakdown of the recipes that are on the blog. And, you know, I understand that about maximizing nutrition and picking things that are nutritionally dense, but I want to be able to explain it better.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking a plant-based nutrition class through Cornell University online right now. I'm going to be doing some raw food culinary classes over the summer so that I can you know, just so that I can improve my technique and continue making better recipes.
Excellent.
And then next year I'm looking at a health coach program through Duke University so that I can actually, you know, take on clients and get paid. People already ask me how I reverse all my chronic diseases, and so I figured it would maybe be nice to get paid for it.
Oh, yeah. I would encourage that.
So I'm going to be pursuing that sometime next year as time allows.
Excellent. Well, that's really cool. Now, I just thought of a couple other things that I wanted to ask you. You know, coming from the fitness world, a lot of us, myself, I eat a very high protein diet. What are some of the ways to get more protein, but from, you know, your plant-based perspective?
Plants are actually a really good source of protein. Leafy greens are some of the best sources of protein, which is why I try to eat a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
In an ideal world, you should probably be blending and eating or drinking about a head of leafy greens every day. You can also do protein from lentils, and hemp seed is a really good source of protein too. It's one of the only complete plant sources of protein that there is. It has all of the essential amino acids in it, mm-hmm. and it's also a good source of good fat. So
Excellent.
I'm a big fan of hemp seed too.
Yeah, it was, a couple months ago, Onnit sent me a couple of different protein powders, and I know I was supposed to share some of them with you, but I actually did eat them all. I will be ordering more, and I need to visit more often, and I'll bring some down next time, I promise. They were very good.
I can eat almonds again, too, apparently. I used to be allergic to them, and now I can have almonds and pineapple and all the other weird foods that used to show up in my food allergy test.
Wow. Well, pineapple's on sale right now, at least in our area, so yay.
I've been going a little hog wild with the pineapple. So really the first time that I've had it in a couple of years because I was, you know, because it was giving me some problems with my asthma. But after eating all of the probiotics and, you know, recovering my gut flora, I decided that I would, you know, try a small amount and I didn't have any problems. So tried a little more and I ate a whole pineapple. So, yeah,
wow.
I'm having a good time over here.
Yeah, well, I guess if you're eating a whole pineapple, you're probably good to go with that.
I taste some of it. I even fermented the pineapple rind. So there's a lot of stuff that you can do with fermentation.
Wow, no joke. That's really cool. Yeah, I've got a friend out west who he makes his own sauerkraut. And again, you know, it sounds great. And I've got to try that.
I will be putting a recipe up on the blog soon. Now that it's done, I can take pictures of the finished product. And so, be on the lookout for that sometime this week.
Excellent. Very cool. Well, yeah, I'll be adding the link to your blog with this so everyone can go check it out. But I'm super glad that you're sharing these recipes because I know that everything that I've had that you've shared has just been delicious. And, you know, well, I don't have all the same kind of kitchen setup that you do, but I think that there's enough compatible there that's quite good.
Well, that's okay. You can just come eat at my place.
Hey, I like that idea. I think that's great. That's awesome. So, yeah, and all the thousands of people who will hear this podcast will be coming down on buses. I'm kidding. Now, something else that you do that we love to do in the low-carb, primal, and paleo communities are vegetable shreds instead of noodles.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, what we usually have are, you know, simple stuff like you know, butternut squash or, you know, my favorite, zucchini. What are some of the other vegetables that you've found make really good noodles?
You know what? I've actually made noodles out of broccoli stems. You know, I'm not one for wasting food, and I know most people will turn their nose up at it. So I have a spiral cutter, and I cut up the broccoli stems. And when you soak them in a little salt water, they get soft and tender, and then you can put a dressing on them, and it's really good, like broccoli noodles.
That was
a surprisingly good one. Beets also make really good noodles if you like beets. I have a love-hate relationship with them personally, but a lot of people like beets.
Mm-hmm.
Another light one that's really good is cucumber if you want something maybe a little bit sweeter or lighter for summertime. Cucumber with a little lemon juice, sea salt, and some olive oil, and, you know, whatever spices you want to put on there, a little chopped tomato, it's really good.
Awesome.
I've done eggplant.
Whoa.
Yeah, I've spiral cut the jicama and then dehydrated it to make like a crunchy noodle.
Wow.
Yeah, that's just that you can sprinkle them on recipes too. It's really good. If it can be spiral cut, I've probably tried it. If you want something sweeter, apples are always really good too. You can do like an shred some carrots and spiralize some apples and throw some raisins and cinnamon in there and make like an apple slaw.
That's
also good.
Well, those are a ton of really good ideas. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome.
This is great. And you know what? We'll want to check in with you again, you know, maybe after you finish your course or, you know, whenever you've got something new, a new discovery in the kitchen for us, which I know that happens often, but we would
yes,
love
the accidental discoveries are the best.
Yes, yes. And, you know, it's funny, too. I think it's so important not to waste food, especially when you're buying all organic food. You know, the prices are not low, no matter where you buy them. And, you know, it's like you just don't want to waste any of this stuff. It is all good. I love that broccoli stem idea because I love broccoli stems. They taste like really good kohlrabi, you know, and they're easier to find. So I'm going to definitely have to try that.
Cool. On another note about the price of organic food, too, when I was still taking all of the medications because of the health conditions that I had, I mean, they weren't cheap. I was on thyroid medication. I had two different inhalers, a prescription antihistamine, a nasal steroid, I know, and there was some other, like, leukotriene blocker or whatever that they wanted to put me on, and all that stuff really added up. And when I looked at how much per month I was having to spend for prescriptions versus what I pay now for, you know, healthy organic food, you know, I actually come out better paying more for my groceries now. So it's totally worth it.
Totally. Awesome. Well, thanks so much. We'll go ahead and catch up with you again, and I'll go ahead and put that blog post link below, and it's great to hear from you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Yay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.